So how do you re-engage the value of black voters, black workers, and the black community for 2022?
I think we just got to keep talking to them. We can't be silent. We have to, they have to see us as a trusted messenger of the information. We have to get more information to voters, not less. I know, you know, the only time we really engage people is right when it's in election time, but election is 365 days a year, 24/7. And we don't do a good job of that. And so if we could figure out how to keep our voice in front of the voters, even when it's not election time, they will continue to view us as a credible messenger, trusted messenger, someone that they will follow and be motivated to actually go to the polls and do what they need to do.
Yeah, I think your statement is such that we need to stop just focusing on the days just prior to the election and then just start treating it like it's an election every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And all the time. Not a whole lot of stuff. I mean, you know, local races matter as well as presidential. So we have to actually have our voice in the space when there are local school board, city council races as well, and helping to motivate and mobilize voters during those elections as well.
Sure. Well, Sister Tella, I'd like to thank you very much for being our guest tonight. We are really looking forward.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. And today we're here with Mario Mora from La Resistencia. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us again. This is maybe third or fourth time being on the show over many years, talking about all the amazing work that's happening out here in the Pacific Northwest to abolish ICE, close down detention centers, and just fight for the rights of people from all over the world. So can you give us some context how you fit into all that and how you got involved with it and all these great projects?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the Pacific Northwest has only one big detention center. It's called the Northwest Detention Center. Well, they actually changed the name to Northwest ICE Processing Center. We still call it the Northwest Detention Center, or Tacoma Cages, if you want to as well. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter the name. There's still a huge cage where about 2,000 people can be detained at any given day. Our work of La Resistencia began in 2014 when the largest, so far, hunger strike happened in a detention center. So in March of 2014, 1,200 people went on hunger strike, and they called us to support them. And we have since been in support of people in detention. We followed their leadership with the aim of shutting down the Northwest Detention Center and ending all detentions and deportations. Like you said, we've been on the show many times because we've been doing this work for a long time. We believe that the immigration enforcement system is the extension of the prison system. It's just another way of controlling our population, in this case, the immigrant, low-income, black and brown communities. And in this case, in the Pacific Northwest, it's also a business because the detention center here in Tacoma is owned and operated by GEO Group, one of the largest private prisons and detention centers companies in the world. And so they really benefit from this contract that they have with ICE to run this detention center as what it is, a business. And so people in detention have gone on hunger strikes many, many times. They've done several different types of actions. They've organized for many years to expose the detention conditions, to expose the immigration system in itself that makes it so hard for them to win the cases. And so our role has been to bring light to what's happening inside so we can actually fight to end the system as it is. And so far, so good.
Can you give some context, maybe just for people who maybe kind of don't know or maybe just don't maybe understand the complexity of how a place like this even kind of exists as far as maybe, the, you know, history of it coming to be, but the deep connections there with the state basically, you know, setting all these things up over many years from, I mean, you know, now it's, you know, early 1900s, you know, what immigration looked like at that time. Mm-hmm. And then fast forwarding to, you know, the 21st century and how radical a transformation it's become and more and more really evil and draconian.
Yeah, I think that we have to start from the very beginning. I mean, the stealing of the lands of Native Americans by the settlers, the white settlers, they didn't want others to come and steal the land that they just stole. And so when immigration law comes into play, they want to make sure that others don't do what they did. So they're really good at keeping others out. They only see immigration as commerce. So they think, okay, if people come and they want to do commerce with us, fine, but they're not going to stay. So from the very beginning, immigration law has been rooted in this racist, xenophobic, capitalistic system that the US is. And it grew accordingly to what the system needed. So, you know, from the late 1800s, where laws were very racialized, very clear, for example, against the Chinese community. Then they moved to against the Filipino community. They even went against the Irish until, you know, the Irish were accepted as white. But before then, they were seen also as non-desirable. And so immigration law has been used to control populations to come into the country only to work and live, to be disposable of. And so as the immigration laws continue advancing according to what the capitalistic US system needs, they also are faced with resistance. So for many years, many communities have fought against these levels of control. And it wasn't until mid 20th century where people fight the racist explicit law, immigration laws, where it favored white people to come into the country versus other nationalities. So that was a struck down. But at the same time, we have that, for example, the World War II happened and the US looks for Mexican labor to come and work. They allowed to come and work the fields where most of their people were being killed in Europe. And when they come back, they're like, okay, I don't need you anymore. And they start deporting Mexicans, even Mexicans that were US citizens. So again, so we see this replica of, I want you to work here, but then I don't want you anymore. They did it with Chinese, they did it with Filipinos, they did it with us, with Mexicans. And then in the 1980s, we have this explosion of the war against drugs, right? And what we see is the big opening for the private prison companies to come in that were already being developed since the 60s because of, let's remember, you know, prisons are also a system of exploitation. And Alabama was one of the big ones on having prisoners working in the fields, the cotton fields. And they were producing a lot of money already for the state. And people that work on that, on getting black people that were in prison working the cotton fields, they move into the private enterprises and they created private prisons. So by the 80s, we have this boom of private prisons. Again, communities fight against them. There was a big abolition movement against private prisons. And by the late 90s, they realized they're losing ground. They don't have the big business that they wanted. So they start moving into immigration detention. And immigration, very racist, but civil system, not a criminal punitive system. They're separate. So in immigration, we don't have the right to a lawyer. We don't have the right to remain silent because that's within the criminal system. It's just civil. So for example, if you want to get married, you go to the court and get your license. And if you want to get divorced, you go back again to that court and say, I want to get divorced, but they don't give you a free lawyer, right? You have to pay your own lawyer. Well, in immigration, it's the same. It's an administrative fault. And if you want a lawyer, you have to pay for one. Yet, when the private system comes into play, they change the rules. So there's a big clientele for them. And part of that was to precisely change how immigration law functions. And what they needed is to create a big, large community of undocumented people that would end up in detention. And that's why we saw the change in immigration laws in 1996 with Clinton, when he basically closed the door to the few possibilities that we had in the past to legalize. Clinton is the one that created the bottleneck of 11 million people stuck here, me amongst them. And by the time that Bush's son gets in power, the companies are lining up. 9/11 happened, and it's the perfect excuse to privatize the detention immigration system and to change it completely. They undo the past Immigration Naturalization Services Agency that ran for many, many decades immigration, and they create ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, within the larger structure of Department of Homeland Security. So they move us from, you know, in the past to commerce, then we were in labor, Department of Labor, and that now they move us to Department of Homeland Security. We become the enemy. We become a matter of security. And so that was the premise to create this big system to say, we have to have big detention centers. We have to have thousands of people detained because we are afraid of them and they need to be deported. And this is just perfect for companies such as GEO to come and build a detention center here and started operating it in 2004. And ICE started in 2003. So it's an agency that hasn't been around that long, but is one of the agencies with much more money than, you know, the Department of Education, Department of Health, or Department of Housing. And none of those agencies have the amount of money that Immigration Customs Enforcement have to come and round us up because we're immigrants.
And what I hear you saying is it has a lot to do with all kinds of heinous laws and policies. And where do those kind of play in as far as, you know, things that were that pivotally kind of changed everything?
Well, definitely. We saw, for example, the experiment that happened in Arizona in 2005 when the GEO precisely started working with that famous organization, ALEC. I don't remember what each the acronym means.
American Legislative Exchange Council.
There you go. Thank you. So they go around, right? Every state, thank you, Adam, to every state to put these demos of bills, right? They have the bills already set. They're copies for every state, every legislator that wants to introduce it. And the aim is to criminalize people so they have further clients coming in into the detention center to make it easier to excuse our detention by saying that we're committing crimes. And so these state legislations, what they do is they create the ground to say, these people should not be here. These people are committing crimes that didn't exist before, now they're crimes. And that happens at state level, but there are also things happening at federal level. So just for example, in 2009, Congress passed a law mandating a bed quota for immigration detention. So no other law enforcement in the country has a quota except ICE. And what the Congress said was there should be available 34,000 beds anywhere in the country for immigration detention. And ICE and Homeland Security interprets that as we need to fill 34,000 beds. And with time, they increased that number to the point that we saw the Trump regime coming in, utilizing this huge machine that was created with the support of state legislation and federal legislation to at some point have 50,000 people detained across the country. Obama, the deporter in chief, we will never forget it, deported 3 million people in his time. Not even Trump deported as many as he did. But they all are part of this infrastructure that is the perfect business and is the perfect machine to trying to control our community, trying, I emphasize trying, because they have not succeeded in controlling our community.
And when it comes to community, I mean, that's really the whole ball of wax of the root of all this great organizing that's been happening. And I think maybe when the first time I met you might have been around 2009 or 2010 or something, and just constantly going to the detention center and doing everything from outreach and giving out, you know, I think people were giving out coffee to family members, loved ones who were visiting and things like that. And how did all that come to be? Because that's been such a strong force for such a long time, and so many people have been involved throughout.
Yeah, I mean, we had even Tacoma residents that even before the detention center was built, they were already against it. So we have, for example, Tim Smith and the Bill of Rights Committee that they put together to respond against this, and they fought the city council, and they learned what the bidding process was. They learned as much as they could about the contract, and they kept fighting. And it was great that they started, because by the time we come in, they have a lot of information set for us. Ready to try to understand how this system worked here in Tacoma. And the other is that because once the detention center opened, they needed to fill it. They go, ICE goes around and start just grabbing people left and right from our communities. So communities respond by going directly to the detention center and realizing, gosh, what is this place? And it's so far away from everything. Because most of the people detained were being not only from the Seattle area, but they were all from almost the Canadian border, to Eastern Washington, to Southern Washington, and even people from Oregon. And so people started organizing themselves by saying, well, people come from really far, let's at least give them some coffee while we're here. And it grew to the point that there were also other groups like International Action Committee, the Socialist Party here in Seattle, that started going quite often to the detention center with signs, you know, against GEO, against ICE. And by the time we do our first civil disobedience, there was already an infrastructure of groups here and there that all they needed was that little spark, right? And we weren't the spark, it was the hunger strike, the spark. We just were the excuse for the people detained that were already organized to finally come out and say, okay, you guys are organized outside, that's what we needed. And then on March 7 of 2014, 1,200 people gone hunger strike, they call us, and we were ready to respond by then.
For folks just tuning in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland, and we're here with Mario Mora from La Resistencia. And to learn more about the organization, you can simply go to their website, laresistencianorthwest.org, and that's Northwest as in the letter, so laresistencianw.org. And we're talking about all the great organizing that's been happening, community mobilizations, all the different organizations getting involved, and friends and family member and just concerned people. What's the transformation from a lot of the direct outreach that was happening like that into everything from you know, policy change and getting this whole mess just abolished, but in this case at least starting with the closing of the Northwest Detention Center? Can you talk about kind of how all this shifted and all these kind of positive efforts have really gained a lot of momentum?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference between handing people coffee that come to visit their loved ones detained to actually saying we're going to shut it down and have your loved ones released and back with you at home. And I think what worked is that we realized from the very get-go, I personally realized that I was being very arrogant when we organized the first civil disobedience. I thought I'm going to get detained, and once I get detained, I'm going to organize inside the Northwest Detention Center. How wrong was I? Because people were already organized. That's why they launched a hunger strike of 1,200 people. How do you organize that, being detained? You know, it's such an amazing skill to do that. And so people were ready. And so what we learned is we need to follow the leadership of those detained. And that's really what worked. So we started listening to them, following their commands. We basically were like, what do you want us to do? One of the best organizers ever that I met in detention, Cipriano Rios Alegria, that passed in 2019, he told me, Maru, this is not a bureaucracy. you have to figure out things on your own as well. So he really taught us how to organize outside with the leadership of those inside. And with time, we also develop a kind of a philosophy that we're not gonna call politicians, they have to call us. And they did. We got some politicians at federal level that would come our way and say, okay, we wanna support. We actually had a good bill in Congress introduced in 2015 to close down detention centers, private detention centers, if they didn't meet, you know, the basics. Obviously it never passed, but it, at least it was a good idea to start seeing a change in Congress that, you know, instead of adding more beds to detention, it said, well, actually we should close it down if they don't meet the standards. So from there, we went into more hunger strikes, supported more hunger strikes. In 2017, when the Trump regime takes over, I thought, well, you know, we might not see organizing activity in the inside, and it actually turned out to be the opposite. People got more organized with more strength, and people here in Tacoma in February of 2017 let us know that they were being transferred to NorCor, the jail in the Dalles, the Northern Oregon, and they were being transferred as retaliation or for those that had appeals, and appeals might take a year. They will dump them there in NorCor, and they didn't have access to law library, they didn't have access to visas, they couldn't see their lawyers, you name it. And by May of 2017, that they're transferred there, they organized a hunger strike. And we called the community in Oregon, and the Dalles community responded. They organized to support the hunger strikes in 2017 at NorCor. And same thing, you know, they were already against the jail. They were already against the idea of having immigrants also being detained there. And by following the leadership of those detained, a couple of years later, they got what they wanted, which was to end the contract with NorCor and ICE. And everything because of these hunger strikes that started here in Tacoma. And so we just continue following the same, you know, let's listen to people in detention. Let's, and also we changed targets. Like in the beginning, our target was Obama. But once Trump takes office, we're like, forget it. We're not gonna get anything there. Let's focus at the local level. And we go after the city of Tacoma. And the city of Tacoma not only agree with us, but they became our supporters. They passed a resolution in support of getting people released because of COVID. They supported the introduction of a bill that we presented at state level to prohibit private prisons and detentions for profit for adults in Washington. So we had all of the sudden politicians at a local and a state level coming our way, reaching out to us and saying, I think you're right, maybe we should do something against this. By 2019, 2020, we see a big change in localities and that we were able to move things at local level that we couldn't do at federal level. But also at that time, we realized a lot of people have been released from detention, and it was time to change in Resistencia as well. So Resistencia used to be a lot of academics and US citizens. I was really the only undocumented person. And at the end of 2019, I set up to find a group that will lead Resistencia, that were people with experience of the system. November 2020 comes, we have a full group that is all people with experience of the system that either have been detained themselves or have relatives detained. They are, you know, they know the system in and out. And, you know, 2020 gets here, we have this full leadership team. They are the ones meeting with the legislators. They're the ones deciding what to do next. They decide the strategy with the communication with people in detention. So you have people that were detained talking to people currently detained, telling them, I was inside, I know how it feels, I know why we need to shut this place down, what do you want us to do? So how wonderful is that, that you actually have now leadership, you know, honest, clear leadership from both inside and outside, that no wonder 2021 has been such a great year for us in regards to so many successes and victories.
Yeah, that's great news. And it seems also that there was just so much kind of consciousness raising going on in the last, within kind of the last 2 years now. I mean, just around issues of race, you know, and the momentum of Black Lives Matter consciousness. And it seems like those things have also helped to kind of coalesce to fight, I mean, the fascist regime that was Trump and now moving on right to the next one, you know, and I was curious what you think about kind of, yeah, moving on to the next one, because now we're in this next phase. We're like in the Biden phase, right? You know, it's like we went from whatever you call that, like alt-right clownism to white neoliberalism, you know, the other side of the coin, essentially, right? What does that entail as far as like what needs to be done, and how has that landscape maybe changed the political environment as well?
You know, I think that Resistencia has always kept the line on detentions and deportations, yet we are founders of Mi Gente, which is a national Latinx group that wanted to create a political space for us Latinx people that we don't have. And our founder, Marisa Franco, she's such a visionary that she saw, okay, we cannot just stay in immigration. We need to jump on all issues. Latinx people are not only immigrants, right? We have many other identities. And one thing that she saw coming was the fight in the South for seats in Congress. And another of our founders of Mi Gente is Georgia Latino Alliance for Human Rights that are in Atlanta. And they mobilized along with the Black community when Stacey Abrams launched her campaign for governor in Georgia. And they really rocked the electoral movement there. They've never done electoral movement, but they saw the need to it. And they proved that Latinx people vote, that Latinx people can actually change elections. And in combination with the Black community, I mean, it was huge. Obviously, you know, the current governor stole the seat because he was already in charge of elections in Georgia. But it created this big momentum that helped the Democrats got in power again in the White House and in Congress. You know, it was really thanks to the Southern Latinx and Black communities coming together to rock the elections to have the Democrats in power. So when Biden won, we knocked at his door and we were like knocking him down because we were like, well, thanks to us, you are now in power and you better respond to us. So we pushed the door in. We started meeting with the now Director of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. And our biggest push was you need to change deportation priorities because Trump had everybody's a priority. Everybody leaves, everybody's detained, and everybody's out. And we actually were able to change something that have never happened in immigration enforcement, which is Homeland Security telling ICE, well, not everybody is a priority. And even people with criminal records are not a priority. You need to first look at all these other contexts, all these other factors in their lives before you make them a priority, which is huge. That's huge because, again, you know, the criminalization against our community has been the excuse to detain us in the first place. And this memo that we fought for, and it was released on September 30th, showed that we were able to move them. But we had to do all this electoral work on the side to move them to you know, sit down at the table with us, or to allow us to at the table, actually. And so the memo not only says that, it also calls for the end of retaliation, you know, respecting civil rights, because so many of us were targeted by the fascist Trump administration just because we spoke up. And not only undocumented immigrants, you saw it with BLM, so with Antifa, you know, so many people, Homeland Security came after all of us, with or without papers. And so to have a memo that says, no, you can't do that anymore, it was great. Now we have to see it being enforced. And that's the next step of our work, is to actually see this enforced and have a review of how ICE is doing things and making sure that they see themselves watched. You know, they don't like to be exposed. They don't like to give explanations. And now what we're doing, we're pushing them to open the door. We're pushing them to show us what they're doing. Not because with that they're going to change and they're going to become good people. No, but it's just another way to facilitate the end of the system altogether. So it did give us a little opening. On the other hand, we see that one of the executive orders that Biden signed almost at the very beginning of his administration was to continue what Obama said, to end federal private prison contracts, and he hasn't. We saw the vice president, when running in the campaign promising to end private detention for immigrants, they haven't. As a matter of fact, instead of ending it, they're filing lawsuits, for example, against California for passing their own laws against private detention centers, which it was done by Trump, but once Biden came in, didn't stop that lawsuit. They actually continue the lawsuit against California for this legislation against private detention centers. So in one hand, we have really good results that we're still fighting for. And on the other hand, they have not delivered what they promised.
Well, thanks so much for the amazing work. We look forward to hearing about when this draconian dungeon gets closed down, as well as the rest of them all over the United States, and hopefully the world too. And we hope people support the organization. Make sure you check out laresistencianw.org. That's the website, laresistencianw.org. For more information, how you can support the organization, get plugged in, help out, and listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. So much thanks, Madhu, for being with us again. We'll hope to have you again soon. And special thanks to Prison Pipeline Collective member Karen James for post-production.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent